I hope you guys enjoyed the conference, and I will say that I think you guys made the right choice to invest in a wake-up call this morning. I think you're going to get a lot of value out of this session. We intentionally put it at the end of the conference, because in a lot of ways, it's in some sense almost the closing keynote for the web content track. At least I like to think of it that way. And I think there is a lot of stuff to learn. So let's dive in. Oh, my name is Ethan Goresh. I'm a lead program manager on the SharePoint Enterprise Content Management team. If you have questions after the session, we run out of time. I can no longer direct you to ask the experts. But please come take my card. My email address is ethang@microsoft.com. I love to field questions. It'll probably take me about a week to get back to you after this conference, but I will do my very best. So I wanted to actually start with a quote from Arthur C. Clarke, that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And I wanted to bring this up because I know that, frankly, both as an engineering team, as we started building out this ambitious vision for search-driven websites in SharePoint 2013, and even during the session, from the many attendees I've talked to after my own sessions, after other sessions in the web track at Ask the Experts, a lot of you, I think, have gotten a really good sense of what the product can do. You know, whether that's designing sites in the design tool of your choice, using search to build some amazing adaptive experiences, having friendly URLs and search engine optimization, a lot of really powerful experiences, and probably culminating in the 0 to 60 live session on Tuesday afternoon for those of you who went, where everyone I've talked to and all the feedback I've seen says, I loved the session. I don't know exactly how it all works, but I think it's really cool they were able to do it. And this session really is about the how. I want you all to come away with this session with two things. First and foremost, you're going to understand how every bit of a search-driven site works. And secondly, from a planning and architecture perspective, I'm going to start to educate you on some of the key decisions that you're going to have to make as you choose to roll these things out, whether those are key configuration decisions, topology and scale-out decisions, because a lot of what we've added to the product has frankly changed the landscape the way you might have known it from 2010. And I want to give you all a head start on understanding what are the big decisions and choices you'll have to make. So, first and foremost, quick recap on what a search-driven site can be. Search-driven sites can be media-centric sites, like the site that you saw in the video session presented by David Cohen on Wednesday. They can be page-centric sites, like the ones that you saw in Lincoln Damaris' session on Tuesday morning, I believe, around building knowledge management portals. And it can also be item catalog-centric, like the Contos Electronics site that you may have seen in the keynote or the earlier sessions that I presented along with some other speakers. And fundamentally, these sites aren't any different as far as how they need to be architected, what they need to build. Everything I'm going to tell you today applies equally well to all of them, even though for the purposes of going deep on one example, we're going to use the item catalog-centric example. And there are a few page archetypes in a search-driven site. Right? Part of what we talk about when we think about the power of SharePoint and dynamic URLs and using search to roll up content means there aren't actually that many different types of pages or even necessarily page instances that go into a site. So here are some of the key types. First and foremost, a fairly easy one to understand, a dynamic page with a single URL. So think of your site homepage. Right? It's got only one URL, and thankfully in 2013, it's just slash. It's not slash pages slash default. And it's a single page, there's only one address for it, but there are a lot of different dynamic behaviors on the site. There's a content search web part that might be rolling up recommended products, most popular products. There's still a lot of dynamic behavior on this page. The second type is a dynamic page with multiple URLs. So if you think about in your search-driven model, what we call the category pages, so the cameras page on Contos Electronics, really behind the scenes here, there's only one page, right? Could be called category.aspx, and all of its behavior is coming dynamically through the URL context or some other context. So there's one page, but when you go to the cameras page, it renders with the camera context. When you go to the phone page, it renders with the phone context. And similarly, the item details pages as well. You get to create a single page called productdetail.aspx that, again, will get rendered completely differently based on the context it's in. When you look for a given product, that ID comes through in the context, and so this page is created. Even though I don't have to make a million different pages to render a million different products, I just have to make one or a few. And lastly, there's the one you're probably most familiar with, a static page with a single URL, which of course still has a place in modern websites. Things like your FAQ page, where users are going to just author some content, Those pages still exist. We love them in the new system. They're still here. But for the purposes of today, where I really want to teach you guys the complete depth, we're going to use the second archetype as sort of our lens to look through this. So we're going to spend this entire session going deep on how the cameras page at Contos Electronics really works. So here's our camera page. And now, let me really quickly show you guys the logical architecture you should have in mind for how these sites are really built. So let's start with your content. And there's three data stores that I'm going to put in here. I will say, for clarity and convenience, I've intentionally modeled these as sort of data stores. The probably best mapping is either a single service or a single site collection. There's a lot of great conversations we can have about how many content databases should there be, or what if I have more than one site collection. As you'll see as we go through this, for now, let's just assume that there's one. The presentation doesn't change, or what you need to do does not really change as you add more. And in fact, I'll talk about that towards the end of the session. But at least for this example, let's assume that there's a single content site collection. It might have had data imported from an ERP system like Dynamics. It might be hand-authored content in a list. It might be pages in a pages library. But that content site collection, let's see, does the pointer work? The content site collection is where you'd think of users going and hand-creating content. Now, a lot of those products are going to reference some binary assets, right? Camera images, right? PDFs of white papers and product manuals in this case, or whatever documents or other assets might apply to you. Those are in a separate site collection, which I've named the asset site collection. And there's URL links between them, right? So when you go to create a camera, you might have a URL property on the camera item that says, what's the URL to the picture for this camera, that links off to an asset in the asset site collection. And then lastly, in sort of where the content is, there's your term store. So the way that your products will get grouped and organized are effectively going to be by terms and taxonomy. So you'd have a managed metadata column on each of your products that might be rolling up to say, is this a camera? Or what type of camera is this? And that's the way that content will later be aggregated and grouped for search. So that's the content itself. Up next is the search index, the centerpiece, so to speak, of a search-driven site. So search index, I've drawn it in the same color, and that doesn't mean much other than it's another logical group to think about. And there's a few things that are important to know there. The primary relationship that the search index has with the content itself is through crawl, right? The process of actually iterating through the content and ingesting it into the search index. And also, there's some really amazing features around recommendations and query rules that we'll talk about more that sort of affect the other side of search, the query side of search. And finally, there's the rendering site collection. So when you think of the URL, the site collection that your site visitors will go access, that's the one that they have access to. And the way it works, it's connected to that same term store, and that's how you would do managed navigation. So you'd say, I'm reusing those same set of terms in the navigation on the rendering site that I used to tag content in my content site collection. And the primary way that it'll interact with the content is actually through the search index, through queries. When you go and look at the cameras page and you see the set of cameras that are there, it's coming from the search index. Those are all search results to us now. The fact that those came from the content site collection originally isn't actually used at render time. And of course, there's also links off to the asset site collection, because the way that that user's browser is going to get that camera image is that the URL that gets rendered in there is going to be directly served up from the asset site collection. And we'll go in through more detail on lots of these nodes next, but this is the general diagram that you're going to see a lot throughout this next hour, and probably borrow from my slides and show your own internal teams as you do your own deployments, and that's great. Please feel free to do so. One other thing I wanted to note, I'm going to share with you guys a bunch of numbers. I won't go too deep into the charts this morning because the exact numbers aren't quite relevant because your own deployments will vary. But we do a whole lot of performance and capacity testing before we release the product to make sure it's good enough. And I wanted to share a couple of details about how we run our systems. So I put up some hardware specs there. That's not an endorsement of any particular processor or exactly how much RAM to use. That is how much we use to test our system. And I wanted to point out that it's fairly middle-of-the-road hardware. About half of you are probably running SharePoint on beefier servers today. And we happen to do a lot of our testing with four web front ends. Again, I have a couple of charts talking about the differences between adding front ends and performance. But there is one important detail I did want to mention that we found from our testing I think will benefit everyone here. There are a lot of different roles that you've probably heard about. For example, with search, there's index nodes, there's crawler nodes. And one particular affinity that we noticed is that in SharePoint, we noticed that the web front-end role and the index role are incredibly compatible to run on the same hardware. They don't actually bottleneck on the same resources. So in all of our testing, we've actually learned that having a single machine be both an index node and a web front-end node worked incredibly well and had very little performance penalty. So that's the one that I would encourage you guys to do the same, because that's what we've done. So let's start walking through the page. So the first area we're going to talk about is friendly URLs and managed navigation. So these little red boxes here show you the parts of the page I'm talking about. And by the end of the session, this whole screen will have at some point been covered in red. So there's the URL structure itself, the URL that lets it be electronics.contoso.com/cameras, as well as the data underlying that navigation, right? So how does it all work? We're going to play a quick game of follow the bouncing ball. So the first thing that happens is that a user browses to the rendering site collection. They have the URL contoso.com/cameras. Now what that rendering site collection, and more accurately the web front ends on it, are going to do is they're going to make a call off to the managed navigation, the term store, to look up the cameras term that's being used for navigation and figure out what page is supposed to be used to render it. So in this case, the cameras term is mapped to categorypage.aspx. And SharePoint behind the scenes is going to take that data and rewrite the URL accordingly. So no user knows that the URL that SharePoint's using internally is categorypage.aspx, you know, with a query parameter in effect saying what, you know, use cameras for this rendering. No user knows that, but under the covers, that actually is what's happening. So when SharePoint tries to render that categorypage.aspx with the camera context, there's a content search web part on it. And that's what causes all those, that's what causes six cameras to show up in the search results as opposed to six phones or six anything else. So that query is going to run. Of course, that's going to mean it's going to go off to the search index to actually issue that query and get the results back. One thing you'll notice that the ball is not doing right now, the ball is not actually going to go to the content site collection. At this point, to render the page, content search is returning a set of results. And like I said before, the fact that those results happen to be in search means the rendering site doesn't need to know where they came from. Could have been content on a different farm, could be non-SharePoint content that was crawled. At render time, we love search results. That's all we need. So a few configuration choices that you should be aware of when you try to think about, this is great, but what do I need to know when setting it up? The first thing I wanted to point out, there are a few different sharing models for how to make your tagging term set that you use for tagging those cameras part of your navigation. So the first one that I'll talk about is reuse. So you can go to the term store manager, and you can go to the tagging term set that you're using, and you can say, I want to reuse those terms in the managed navigation term set on my rendering site collection. And when you do that, you get a reference to those terms. So if someone goes off and renames the camera term, that change will propagate through to your site. But reuse allows you to change the relative position of those terms. So you could say that even though internally we think of, let's say, video cameras as a child of cameras, I don't want on my rendering site customers to have to know that. They might think of them as separate logical products. And when you reuse your terms, you can actually move them around separately. So in effect, you're reusing each individual term, but you're not locked into the hierarchy in place in the source. Pinning, however, is truly locking the entire term set and subtree. In effect, when you pin, you're creating a symbolic link or symbolic reference to the entire term set and its children directly in managed navigation. So I have no good answer for you about which one is appropriate for you. It really depends on whether you think you might want a different presentation of your term hierarchy on navigation context versus authoring. If that's what you want, you should reuse. If you have a consistent set that you want to manage in one place and have constantly in sync, then you want pinning. Cross-site publishing is the next major configuration choice that you need to think about. And one thing I will note, there's very little functionality of cross-site publishing that's truly unique to cross-site publishing. I know we did a whole session on it, and it's a fantastic feature. But by and large, you should really think about it as, in effect, a wizard to help you streamline this process. So it'll help you pin the navigation. It'll help you build the right catalogs, which are, in effect, predefined search scopes. It will help streamline a lot of that automation, but it's not something you necessarily have to use. You could build pretty much all of that functionality more or less on your own without using it. You could go make your own content search web parts. You could trim the queries in the way that you want. But it's a wizard we have, and we think it, that the model it pushes you down is the one that 90% of you will want. So I strongly encourage you to use it. But just know that there's not a ton of magic there. There's really more automation and streamlining there, which is important. But don't be confused about what it does and doesn't do. And lastly, category pages. So I mentioned earlier that every term in the managed navigation term set is bound to a URL of what is the page used to render it. By default, when you use cross-site publishing, for example, we will assign a URL to the root term that you reuse. And by default, that URL will inherit. So when you first connect to cross-site publishing, there's one category page that all your products would be using. You can change that, though. You can go at any point and say, I want a different category page unique to cameras, or even unique to SLRs within cameras. You can make that change, and it's really up to you as far as which term should use sort of the standard one that you have and which term should be unique. So it's flexibility in your control. So that's configuration. I do want to talk briefly about some topology and scale points that you should be aware of. The first question that we often get from customers is, I love the idea of managed navigation. How deep should my hierarchy be? And so we've tested up to about 1,000 terms in a managed navigation term set. There's a separate question, of course, about, you know, will your users hate navigating your site if your navigation structure is 1,000 terms deep? That's a business choice you get to make. But I will say that we've tested 1,000, and practically speaking, that works out pretty well, because I will point out, having a term in the navigation term set is not the only way to get what we call a friendly URL. One of the things that cross-site publishing will do, for example, is it will automatically create friendly URLs based on product ID for every product or every page, right, in your catalog. Managed navigation terms are really more about the categories. So 1,000 categories actually tends to be quite a lot. It's not saying that you only get 1,000 friendly URLs. The other thing I wanted to point out is when I say we've tested this thing, one question, of course, is, well, what's the performance that you then get? And I did want to at least briefly point out, I have a whole chart with number of front ends, but at the 4-web front end configuration, we tested a site that had about 1,000 terms, so 1,000 categories, had 5 million pages, and our performance there on the hardware I showed you before was frankly great. We managed to easily serve up about 100 requests per second to browse content, and all those requests got served on average with less than 500 milliseconds of latency. So when I say we can do it, I don't mean you need a ton of hardware, and I don't mean it will be a bad experience. On the hardware we showed, which again, many of you probably already have better hardware, it's a great experience overall. And we'll talk more about how caching and performance improvements we've made make that happen. All right, so up next, let's talk about our content search queries. And the first thing I want to note, you've probably heard it a few times this conference, but it's early enough in the morning, I want to make the point really clear. When we talk about content search, rarely do I actually mean when users go into the search box at the top of the page to look for items and get back a list of results. Most of the searches that will happen on this kind of site are the ones I'm showing you here. They're the content searches that are baked into the page directly through content search web part. You know, their searches as a way to aggregate and display content. So let's talk about how those parts of the page actually come to be. So again, the way this starts out, firstly, it starts out well before a user ever sees the content. Behind the scenes, depending on your content crawl schedule, which we'll talk about in just a minute, the search index is going to go off and ingest, right, through the process we call crawl, the content items themselves, the metadata from the term store. It does that so it can get the hierarchy to do things like faceted navigation and refinements. And it ingests those into the search index. In effect, the search index is a projection, or in many ways almost a copy of that content. I will point out, and this will become important in a few minutes, search does not store binary assets. Search is not going to store your images. Search is not going to store your PDFs. It will index those and store data about them. But it doesn't store those, and that's why that asset site collection is there. So now that that's done, at some other point, a user browses that camera's page, right? Through managed navigation, we load the correct page. The correct page has a content search web part in it. And that's going to cause a search query to get issued, right, from the rendering site collection to the search index. Now, the first thing I'll note is that we do have, and I'll talk about it more in the next slide, what we call the anonymous search results cache. It's a new caching layer. It's based on the ASP.NET App Fabric, distributed cache infrastructure to make sure that, you know, we know that when users come in to do, in effect, a search for cameras, though, they don't think of it that way. So I'll say when users come to browse the cameras page, that query is going to return the same results a lot of the time, and there's a huge performance gain to caching that for short windows of time. Right? If you're getting 100 requests per second and caching it just for 5 seconds, you're doing 1/500th of the search query work, right? Just for that sort of freshness. But, of course, sometimes that will be uncached. The first guy to go to the cameras page will end up issuing a query, goes to the search index, and when those results are outbound, they get processed through the query rules. For those of you who've attended a few of the sessions this week on dynamic and adapted experiences, you already know this, but for the rest of you, the simplified way to think of query rules is it's logic you can run on a result set of a search query to transform the query in ways that might make sense for you. You might, for example, want to promote specific products that while they might not have been the most strictly algorithmically relevant, they're the ones you want users to see. And before you think of that as being something that, oh, isn't search supposed to be pure and sites are supposed to do that, Amazon does this to you all the time. You haven't noticed, you're already fine with it, and we give you a ton of power in that platform. So those results go through the query rules, and then they get sent back to the rendering site collection to get rendered in the content search web part, right, displayed on that page. And if needed, we'll put them into the cache. So the next user to come to the cameras page gets this cached experience and doesn't even have to write, or doesn't even have to issue a new search query. And then finally, because we have this incredible analytics and recommendations engine, which hopefully you guys checked out Christopher's session on that earlier in the conference, I have a link to the recording at the end of the deck. But one of the great things about this system is behind the scenes, SharePoint's going to do the work to notice what users did, which pages they visited, what they visited next. And that data is going to actually feed back into the recommendation system. So that in the future, if someone's browsing your cameras page and you have recommendations you want to show, you know, people who clicked on cameras also tended to click on these particular accessories, that data updates automatically and dynamically. There's nothing you have to do other than have that content search web part that's saying, get me items recommended for cameras. All right, so configuration choices. One thing I'll note before you all start frantically reading the slide ahead of me, there have been entire sessions at this conference, an entire search track dedicated to configuring, managing, learning about the search sessions. I encourage you guys to watch them all. What I'm giving you here is a brief teaser of some of the considerations that are especially important for websites. So the first one we should talk about is content freshness. It's one of the first questions we get when we tell customers about the search-driven model, is people tend to ask, oh, but how long is it until I publish a page, until it's really live? Doesn't crawl mean it's a lot slower? I've seen sometimes when I publish something on my website, Bing and Google don't notice it for days. How does it not be that bad? And there's a lot of work we did in our crawling infrastructure to make it far, far better than that. If you're properly configured, our continuous crawl feature, which is in effect crawling your content almost all the time, on the reference hardware I showed, content goes live in, on average, less than 2 minutes. And frankly, throwing more hardware at it will buy you even faster performance, and I'll show a slide about that in a second. But again, when you think about freshness being in the 1 to 2 minute range, frankly, with a lot of the caching you want to do, I mentioned earlier how you might want to cache content for 5 minutes anyway, you're down to the point where search crawl is no longer going to be the main bottleneck when you think about how fresh content will be. We've made it a non-issue. The next one to think about here is the number of catalogs. So I mentioned earlier that cross-site publishing was a wizard that could help you, in effect, automate a lot of the search scopes and reuse of content. And then the next question we tend to get is, all right, so would you recommend in this type of scenario that a company like Contoso has one catalog? One catalog per category, hundreds of catalogs. And the truth is, it's completely a choice that you get to make. And from a scale and performance perspective, there's not a ton of difference between how many catalogs you have. But the general suggestion I would make for when working through this question of how many catalogs do I need is to think about the fact that every time you make a catalog, you get to define some settings that will make it easier for people to reuse that catalog. You'll get to define which of the managed metadata columns is the column that should be used for navigation by default, right? So, and a few other choices like that. And so, really the question would be, think about how you want your content to get reused. If it turns out that you want all the products to generally get reused together, you probably want one catalog. If you want to make it easier for one of your brand sites, like let's say Contoso has a Contoso's camera completely separate site, then you might want to have one catalog just for cameras. So completely up to you, but that's the general sort of algorithm you should have in your head for how many catalogs do I need. Refiners are another one that's important to think about. I showed on the site, and we actually demoed yesterday afternoon even building custom refiners to let you interact with and get that great drill-in kind of experience to your search results. There's a few different ways you can configure those. You can go into any individual page, and you can specify what refiners you want. So you could say specifically that for the cameras category, megapixels is the things I want, but for the laptops page, screen resolution is the thing I want. Or we our faceted navigation settings on the catalog itself can help automatically configure those. So I won't try to go into too much depth on refiners. Frankly, it merits its own hour-long talk. But you should be thinking about how which of those scopes make sense for you when you think about a refinement-based experience. And then I've mentioned a few times the anonymous search results cache. There's a few configuration choices you get to make there. Frankly, they're kind of the same configuration choices you have to make with all caching. There's always this trade-off that we won't ever really solve of, you know, how much work I want to do on each request to my site versus how long I want items to be cached for. There's still that trade-off of how much hardware you want, how much freshness you want, and what your business actually needs. So for the search results cache, the choice really comes down to a couple of things. One, the search results cache has a global value for how long results should be cached for. So you could say I want every 5 minutes reissue the queries, every 10 minutes, 30 seconds, entirely up to you. Our default is actually 15 minutes. But again, you can change it really easily. And the second one is different web parts can also opt in or opt out of participating in the cache. So it's not entirely a binary decision. If you've decided that you have one particular content search that happens at some place on your site that you really want to have updated constantly because the results will change that often, you can opt it out of the cache. All right, so a little bit more on content search, though. So another thing that we tend to get asked a lot is how many content search web parts should I have on my page? A lot of the pages we've shown at the conference tend to have one or two. And there are a few things that it might not be obvious that I wanted to share when you're making that decision. The first one's strictly around performance. When a page is served through SharePoint 2013, we will issue the search queries for your content search web parts in batches of 5. So the decision you make to add your 6th content search web part to the page is actually going to have a material impact on the behavior you see. So keep that limit in mind. The other thing I'll say, for those of you who were in my session yesterday about display templates, you already know this, but different content search web parts can actually share the same search data provider. So you're not strictly limited to 5 different content search web parts, but if your 5 content search web parts are each using their own unique search query, then you'll end up with 5. And lastly, content search web parts can be set to run synchronously or asynchronously. And by that I mean your first set of results, right? You can say that you want SharePoint to run that search query live while it's rendering the page, or first serve the page to the user and run the query asynchronously via JavaScript. So again, there's no magic here as far as there's the decision you'd make about do I want to run a synchronous query or an asynchronous query is a trade-off you get to make about do I need that data as soon as the user hits the page versus what can wait, and do I want the sort of performance characteristics to be more of an asynchronous load delay or a synchronous load delay? We give you that choice. And then lastly, the number of refiners per page, again in the nothing comes for free category. Every refiner that you add to the page has a non-trivial performance impact on the rendering. There's a lot of calculations that SharePoint does for you about if you're refining by color, how many black cameras versus how many red cameras in that count that we show. So be aware that every time you add a refiner, you need to think about how it's going to impact your site performance. And there's no uniform answer. I can't say, you know, it's 100 milliseconds per refiner because it depends on, frankly, the shape of your data. But just be aware that it's one of those that will have a material impact, and it's one you need to test and think about. All right, so I promised some charts. I won't go through every number in depth, but I'll at least help you guys extrapolate some trends. So when you think about crawl speed and content freshness, right, what does it take to actually make sure that I have my content in the site and live as quickly as possible? So rule of thumb, which again, not really surprising, the more crawling and content processing nodes you have, the faster content will get crawled. And the thing we've noted, though, there's two very different sort of crawl load patterns, right? There's the full crawl, the one you hopefully only have to do once, right? That initial crawl of all the millions of items in your site. And then there's incremental crawl, right? Where crawl is running continuously and it's only about crawling what has changed. When you think about continuous crawl, really, the search hardware you have is probably going to be fine. We've actually seen that one node in our hardware lab can handle crawling 50 new items per second. So if you think about the rate of change that would mean on your site, how many items are changing per minute, that's well above what nearly every site, even a huge site like Microsoft.com, often has to contend with. Which means the decision you'll have to make about how many crawlers do you need is really about how long you want full crawl to take for the cases when you need it. Because you will need it both once initially, and also if you make a change to your search schema, for example, you'll need to do a full crawl as well. So here's the quick chart on, in our hardware lab, what you saw. Things to observe, like I said before, one crawler node alone is processing 50 items a second. So for incremental, that's probably plenty. And of course, the number goes up as you add more hardware, but it doesn't go up linearly, right? It's not 50 items, and therefore, three nodes equals 150 items. There is some sort of contention that goes on with writing to the database, frankly, like scaling out anything you've ever scaled out. So don't take these numbers as sort of gospel per se, but just think about that trend, right? You'll have to plan how many nodes you need. This is what we saw in our hardware. All this data is getting published, by the way. But that's the one for you to be aware of. And then, of course, the query side. Again, I have a really unsurprising rule of thumb. The more index and web front-end nodes, the more pages per second you can serve, the more queries per second you can serve. And I have sort of the bars here represent the number of queries per second that we threw out of that hardware, and the sort of the different columns are the number of nodes. So again, the number goes up, but it's not strictly linear because there are other shared resources in place. And I did want to briefly point out, though, the bar that's sort of fairly flat but a little bit bumpy is the actual server response time, the latency that we've seen for total page rendering, not just the queries. So I will note that that number is really flat, which is a good thing. It means that even across all of these nodes, I'm not showing you 35 pages a second with one web front end and it's horribly bottlenecked and the queries are slow. These are all keeping up an acceptable performance level, about 500 milliseconds. All right, and one other thing to note, I've talked about the content search query data that's come back. We're going to talk in just a minute about the rendering, right? For those of you who were in my session yesterday with Jeremy Kelly, you know that the content search web part has its own display template model for how those results get rendered. And it's all rendered client-side with HTML-based templates using JavaScript. So that's the way they get rendered. And those rendering templates are themselves stored in the rendering site collection. They're worked on with the design manager feature that we showed on Tuesday and in the keynote. And this is the part where I should probably make some joke about a Dreamweaver bug, but I'm going to stop kicking them this week. But again, I've said this in every session. To whoever I've seen walking around with the Dreamweaver bug meme t-shirts, I really want one. Please come find me. Let me know what they cost. I think it's a great idea. So let's talk about the rendering site elements. And I'm not going to draw a red box at this point, because really, every single thing on this page is a rendering site element. I talked about the managed navigation. The rendering of the navigation is a rendering site element. I talked about search results. The rendering of that, right, is a display template. So really, we're just going to talk about the rendering site collection and how things work. All right, so a few highlights of features that we've talked about before, but I wanted to put them in context. First and foremost, device channels. One of the things that we showed earlier this week in the Zero to Live session and in my SPC 019 was this notion that in SharePoint 2013, you can specify different device channels and target different renderings of your site for different devices, right? You can do it based on user agent. And as you do that, you can specify totally separate master pages and also other conditional rendering through device channel panels. Master pages and layouts themselves architecturally have not actually changed since SharePoint 2010. We've made massive investments in the design tooling. People now design with HTML and JavaScript. It is a massive improvement, as you hopefully saw if you were in those sessions or just watched the keynote. But underneath the covers, we're still taking those HTML master pages and page layouts and creating the ASP.NET assets that SharePoint's using to render. So under the covers, it's still ASP.NET. We've just made it so designers don't have to know that anymore. And of course, I mentioned before the content search web parts and the refiner display templates are new design templates. These are also created in HTML, but they're rendered effectively in JavaScript on the client. So the client ends up just downloading a couple of additional JavaScript files to render those results. So some things you should be thinking about from a configuration standpoint. Oh, right, and assets related to the designs. So if you think about things like the site logo, any other icons you might have, like the ever-present, you know, Facebook icon or Twitter icon or whichever else you might choose to embed, Those also would generally get stored in that rendering site collection. And those can get cached on disk in the disk-based cache. So a few configuration choices. One feature I want to talk about that we showed a few times, but frankly in passing, is this feature that we call design packaging. It used to be in SharePoint 2010 that if you had a design agency build your site, or even if you just had a dev environment, the act of taking that design, your master pages, your layouts, all those customizations, and bringing them into another site in a way that you can ensure are intact, required you to go into Visual Studio, build WSP packages, or do it by hand in a really manual way. The design packaging feature is terrific, and it gives you, from the design manager, a one-click export this design, and we ensure that we grab everything that you need. All those assets come along with you. It actually makes it a ton easier now to think about that whole, how do I do an update to my design? How do I take it from dev to QA to production? Design packaging is your friend. So please try it out and see for yourselves. Topology and scale standpoint, though, I wanted to mention page output caching. I did mention, right, that since master pages and page layouts are still ASP.NET assets, the knowledge you have in your head about how much page output caching do I need, how much memory do I need to allocate, hasn't really changed. The only two things I'll mention about the new model that modify it a bit, if you have 10 device channels and you use 10 different master pages, all 10 of those now have to actually get cached in the page output cache. So when you do the math on, I have this many pages, I translate that into this much memory, you have to have another multiplier in there for the number of device channels. And the other thing I'll mention, I talked before about you can make your content search web parts synchronous or asynchronous. When you have a synchronous content search web part, the result data that comes back is part of the page and gets into the output cache. So when you think about why you might want to do something synchronously and how much caching benefit you get, there's actually a huge caching benefit to having at least the first page of your content search web part results be synchronous, because then they're in the output cache and they're super fast to render. All right, so now let's go back and talk about those sort of images or other assets shown in the search results. So not my site logo, but rather the images of each of these cameras that my content authors had to create earlier. So a quick conceptual conversation before we go through the bouncing ball diagram. I mentioned this before, I'm going to mention it again. The search index does not store binary assets. So those files, right, those camera images need to be stored somewhere that users visiting your site actually have access to. Because unlike the content site collection, which doesn't need to have anonymous access enabled, these things do need to be somewhere that you can access. The other thing I'll mention, because I'm not going to talk much about it here, but we've hit on it in a few sessions, and it really is your friend when thinking about capacity and performance, is image and video renditions. So the image renditions feature, which will automatically generate different sort of croppings and different size and aspect ratios of the assets you upload, can have a huge impact on the performance your end users see. If you make your mobile users download smaller images, not your original larger ones, they will be happier, you will be happier. It's a great, great thing. And similarly with video renditions as well, the idea that you can have a low bandwidth rendition of the video, right, or a sort of lower screen resolution rendition of the video for your mobile users, or just even users on slower connections, is a good, good thing. It's a feature that will be really easy for you to take advantage of, but when you think about your site metrics, right, user engagement, how fast does the site render, they can have a massive impact. So having said all that, let's talk about how this behavior actually works. So when a user comes in and requests our camera page, right, managed navigation does its thing to make sure the right search query gets issued. The search query gets issued. It comes back saying, here's the top six cameras, because I know the right query context. And now the properties of each of those cameras that comes back in the results is going to include URLs to assets, right? So we could have a URL for the product image for each product that's, you know, assets.contoso.com/camera/camera1.ping, right, or .jpeg. So search comes back, get our results. Now, the next thing that might happen, as we showed yesterday in our display template session, the display template, being JavaScript logic that runs on the client, might choose to fetch a different rendition based on what it knows. The great thing about the renditions feature is all you need is to tack on some query parameters to the actual URL, and SharePoint will give you the best match rendition for what you need. So a display template might say, oh, I know that you asked for camera1.ping, but I would like to display this in a 320 by 240 rendition. Please give me one of those, and SharePoint just does the rest. Then the user's browser, is going to go off to that URL and try to fetch the image. And now, if needed, SharePoint will actually generate the appropriate rendition, because we generate those on demand the first time that someone asks for them. It'll store that in the blob cache, or the SharePoint disk-based cache, and then serve it to the user. And then so users get their 6 camera images, their small renditions, they're happy. All the images are in the disk-based cache, so the next guy to come ask those cameras has an even better experience. And that's how those camera images get back to the user. So, things you need to know, configuration choices. The first one that hopefully I've beat into you by now, because it's the one that people tend to miss and is subtle, that asset site collection that I showed earlier needs to be accessible by site visitors. If you don't, none of those images will come through. Secondly, you need to make sure that your content authors put the assets in the asset site collection, as opposed to the content site collection. We do have tools to help you with this. Some things I'll note. Whenever you have an image field in SharePoint, you can set a default location on the field control, so you can specify that when someone goes to pick a URL for this image for my page, it should browse them straight to the asset site collection where they need to be. Similarly, whenever you have the asset picker loading, in any context, you can specify what are called suggested content browser locations. So you can change the default, you can change the suggestions they get, but you'll need to make sure that that's where that content is. Unless you want to make your whole content site collection visible to anonymous users, which might at first blush sound crazy, but you still have content scheduling, you still have versioning and approval. So whether or not that's a good enough approach for you, purely based on your business needs. I've tried to show you the separate model, not because I think it's better, but because it's easier to take this mental model and shrink it down as opposed to blowing it up and thinking, what happens when I need to have a separate site collection? And then the last one I'll mention, you have to coordinate the scheduling and publishing of those things. It's important now to make sure that if you're setting schedule dates on both the image of the camera and the camera list item itself, those should go live at approximately the same time. Otherwise, you'll have the experience where only part of the content's live. So again, we have those scheduling features, and we have those permissions features, but it's up to you to use them. And another potentially taboo topic, but I wanted to have an honest conversation about it, is should I store my videos and images in SharePoint at all? There's a couple of choices you have to make here. And frankly, we've made this less of a Faustian choice than we had in the past. Because for those of you who saw Dave Cohen's session on videos in SharePoint yesterday, you know that you can actually make video sets for videos stored on YouTube, videos stored on file shares, videos stored anywhere external to SharePoint. It's much less of a divide as far as the user experience that your users will get if the file itself is not in SharePoint. So really, it all comes down to, for you, do you want large video assets in your content database? Or, of course, large image assets, but videos tend to be orders of magnitude bigger. It's up to you as far as how you want to do it. It has to do mostly with how large your content database should grow in general, how long you want backup to take, how much backup volume you want to dedicate. So I won't say that I have an answer for you as to when it's yes or no. It's a more nuanced conversation. But it is a fair question to ask. You shouldn't be afraid to ask it, and we're totally happy working with videos or images not stored in SharePoint as well. And then topology and scale choices. Let's talk about that disk-based cache that I've alluded to a few times. Those of you who are familiar with SharePoint 2010 or even 2007 already know about it. But it's a disk-based cache where SharePoint will store copies of frequently accessed files. And a couple of notes about it. The first thing, when you think about your rendering site collection and your asset site collection, both of them have some image assets, right, or video assets. I mentioned the site logo, right, or some of those branding icons that you might have. Those are going to live in your rendering site collection, and you really do want to cache those, but they won't be very big. If you think about the number, you know, the raw number of megabytes or gigabytes of that kind of Chrome branding binary assets, they're not very large. But it's important to cache them. It has a huge performance gain when you do. However, the asset site collection is the one that's likely to be much, much larger. That's the one where you want to think long and hard about exactly how much cache space you want to allocate. Because you really should try to have as much of that stuff cached as you possibly can. I guarantee you that adding more disk space to your asset site collection front end is going to be one of the cheapest things you can do to actually increase overall performance if you're not fully caching your assets already. And a few notes when you think about how big should my cache be, how much should I be planning for. Image renditions, I mentioned this before. Image renditions are generated on demand, and in the SharePoint content database itself, there's always only one copy of the image, the original image. Those renditions are generated on the fly. They're stored only in the blob cache. So if you think about the fact that you might have, you know, 1 gigabyte of images, if you've got 2 renditions, the blob cache will need to have, you know, sort of approximately 2x of storage to make sure you can handle all of those. And again, you could sort of scale up that math as you need. Video renditions, however, are in fact multiple assets stored in SharePoint. And it's the video set feature in the video player that helps switch you between them. So videos are the more straightforward calculation. If you have 10 gigabytes of videos in your asset site collection, you need 10 gigabytes of disk space, cache space. But that multiplier applies for assets. And so while we're talking about assets, I wanted to hit on another big, meaty topic that tends to come up a lot, which is geodistribution, which is sort of the old name for it, and content delivery networks. So a bit of a history lesson. So when I came to this conference in 2007 and 2009, and even last year in Anaheim, California, for those of you who were there, when people talked about geodistribution, there's this somewhat antiquated mindset that says, what I meant to do when I say geodistribution is I want a data center in Amsterdam, I want a data center in Chicago, I want a data center in Brazil, you know, or wherever you want to put your data centers, and I'm going to mirror everything across all of them. And it turns out the customers who did this, whether they're using SharePoint or not, to be entirely frank, are often kind of sad with the results and the cost of it. It requires a ton of infrastructure, and frankly, no matter what technology you're doing to do that sort of synchronization between data centers, it's complex, it's fragile, it's really, really hard. And it turns out that the people who thought about it have realized that there's actually a better approach. You know, just like people say sometimes pink is the new black or whatever fashion trend those of you who've been shopping this week could tell me about. In 2013, content delivery networks really are the new geodistribution. And the idea is you don't have to replicate all of your infrastructure. If all you did was offload those binary assets, right? So every camera image is actually getting served out of Akamai or Azure, pick your favorite content delivery network. But those initial page requests still come through SharePoint, right? You would get most of the sort of return on investment of geo-replication by just writing a comparatively small check to your CDN provider as opposed to having to run multiple data centers. It's a huge win. And just to put that in perspective, I did some quick math on the electronics.contoso.com site. You can go check this out yourself if you want to. So here's the math on the number of requests and the total. So the bars are the total number of requests. So the homepage of electronics.condosa.com, there's 1 page requests, there's 20-ish JavaScript requests, there's 10 CSS files, there's about 20 images. And there's work we could have done to change those numbers. I could have futzed with it and combined some CSS files into one file. But that's realistically what was there. And so if you do the math on and also the number of kilobytes, right, are the bars. So 450 kilobytes of images. Again, we might have been able to use renditions better, but this was a desktop site. The mobile version does even better. 400 kilobytes of JavaScript. Again, I think for development purposes, we ended up using the full jQuery, not the minified. So you can do a bit better. Your numbers will vary. But the number that does matter is, if you took the approach I'm describing on this site, you worked with a CDN vendor, and you made sure that your JavaScript, CSS, and images were cached. What you'd have is 98.2% of the requests would not hit your data center at all. They'd be served straight from the CDN. And 96.4% of the actual bytes over the wire that come down would be coming from the CDN. So I'm not going to make the argument that's as black as white and saying this site would have gotten 96 or 98% faster. Of course, it depends on where users access from, you know, where the data is. But I will say that without having to buy any additional hardware and just working with a CDN vendor, I can offload 96 to 98% of the work. So if you think about the return on investment cliff that comes from saying that's not good enough, I want to cache that very last request, let's build multiple data centers across the world, pretty much every large customer we talk to, and again, whether they're running SharePoint or not, if you look at how, you know, Facebook runs, CNN.com runs, all your biggest sites, this is the approach they've taken, and it's the way I'd encourage you to think about it as well. All right. So let's talk about some what I've called add-ons to the topology, which are sort of variations. Oh, I shouldn't use the word variations. Which are tweaks to the topology we talked about before that you might be able to think about. There's some patterns that are actually surprisingly easy with search-driven websites that were incredibly difficult in the past. So the first one is having many rendering sites instead of just one. So right now, in all of this session, we've talked about 1 rendering site collection. I don't know if anyone can actually see the pointer. Maybe I shouldn't bother. All right, 1 rendering site collection. There's absolutely nothing that could stop you from having more than one. You can build two rendering site collections that are both pulling off the same search index. Right? So in this case, I've added a second one. And you might be thinking, why would I want that? Well, there's a couple of different patterns we've seen where that's incredibly desirable. One of them is separate brand sites. We have, for example, a very large customer in the US who runs a chain of grocery stores under 8 or 9 different brands in different regions across the country. But they tend to have mostly the same content. They have a recipe section that's shared. They have a list of their products that's shared. They have a bunch of news articles about health that are all shared. And in the 2007 or 2010 world, they had to do a lot of custom work to have this experience of those sites have the same content but look different. In the 2010 world, all they have to do is make another site collection, hook it up to the same catalog, do their own branding, and they're good to go. It's incredibly easy. Microsites is another buzzword, so I'll define what I mean by it for you. But there are definitely some stores that might be, or some customers that occasionally spin up a much smaller site that's just a subset of their bigger site. We have customers that do this, for example, for productive categories or around a new product launch, right? Where let's say for Microsoft, for example, we have Microsoft.com and we had Windows8.com that might be a different site for a while. Again, really easy to just make a different site, brand it differently, pull off of the same catalog. And of course, the other one that you might have seen in Josh Stickler and Kate Kelly's session on Wednesday is if you're a multi-language site and you want to have different country code top-level domains, that rendering site collection can be contoso.com. This other one can be contoso.ca if you're Canadian like I am. It's a really powerful thing, and again, it doesn't require copying around the content, any custom code. It's just make a second site, hook it up to your search index, and you're good to go. The other pattern I wanted to talk about was you can have multiple content sites as well. So over here, we have one content site collection. You could certainly have more than one. And again, you might be asking yourself, why would I want to do that? Isn't one good enough for anyone? And it might be, or you might have other needs. The first reason you might want to do it is a permissions boundary. If you want to have one site collection where everyone in your company can do some work, but you want to have a second site collection for, let's say, the Microsoft Surface pre-launch collateral with completely different permissions, completely different access, you can do that. You just crawl them both. They can get aggregated by search. It's fantastic. Your rendering site doesn't need to know. The other reason, of course, that you might need to do it is to use content deployment, which I think we've managed to make it through 3 days and 2 hours of the conference without talking about. So let's talk about it. Content deployment in SharePoint 2013. Still there, still supported. Frankly, in the search-driven model has gotten much, much, much better. Let me tell you why. So first and foremost, who should use content deployment? Now, the answer in the past, or one thing I'll mention, in the past, in 2007, similar to geo-replication, a lot of customers used to have the mindset, and a lot of analysts helped fuel this problem, that of course you want to have a totally different dev environment, and of course you want to have a totally different copy of your staging environments. And that model, other than sort of the issues we had in the early versions of content deployment, that model might have worked okay when you have a really static site. When you think about a modern website where you have search and relevancy and recommendations and all this dynamic data, the model of having a separate copy of the content doesn't make as much sense as it used to for business and, let's say, manageability reasons, right? But there are some customers out there, probably some of you in this room, who might actually have a legal reason, a regulatory reason, where you say, I by law am not allowed to have some particularly secretive content in my data center, in my production data center, until it's ready to go live. Earnings reports is the most classic widespread example we hear. But we have lots of customers in the financial, you know, industry and healthcare and others. Some people have these rules, and content deployment is for that set of contents. However, one thing that's really good news, since you can have multiple rendering sites, content deployment is no longer the all or nothing proposition it used to be. Right? The story used to be if you had 5% of your content of earnings reports that couldn't be live, you were content deploying 100% of that site collection. Now, because you can actually use search to aggregate, you don't have that problem anymore. So even for those customers, for those of you in this room who would say, yes, I have some content that I must content deploy, I would still encourage you to only content deploy the subset that you need. And I'll show you the topology for that in just a second. The other thing I'll mention, content deployment in the past is kind of a misnomer. It was really everything in my site deployment, but that was a bit of a wordy name, so we shortened it to content deployment. In 2013, content deployment is finally only about content. Because you can have search doing your aggregation, because you have a separate rendering site, You don't have to have sort of a single train pushing your entire site. So it's not like your earnings report going live is now sort of stuck behind your master page change going live. You can change those things separately, and it's incredibly powerful. And to be entirely candid, it's also less error prone, right? A lot of the challenges we've seen in content deployment in the earlier releases, most of which we really have fixed, by the way, but perception matters, and that was the perception back then. A lot of those challenges tended to be around, I set up a custom workflow, I made a change to a content type. All these things that weren't about the content, they were about the other parts of the site. Using content deployment to deploy only your content is incredibly reliable. And I encourage you to think about it that way. There is, though, one quick caveat I'll mention. So in the past, when search was not involved, and you think about what's the latency, right? When I hit the run the content deployment job now button to when it goes live, you had to wait for the export to complete on the source. You had to import to the target, and then you were live. There is now one more step in the search-driven world, right? You have to hit export, or you have to sort of hit run the deployment path, or your schedule has to run it. Content exports, content imports, and then you have to wait for that search crawl. So again, you might have 1 to 2 minutes after import completes, depending on your configuration. Again, you can dial up your hardware up or down to sort of shrink or grow that number based on what you need. But be aware when you're thinking about what is my freshness going to be, that's an extra element to that freshness. So, and the other thing I'll mention too, there's actually a marker feature in SharePoint 2013 now that you have to turn on a site collection if you're going to make it the source of content deployment. And it will actually help you make sure that all you're doing there is creating content and that users aren't changing the managed metadata to use it for navigation in a way that is going to potentially cause you issues with the deployment because you won't see those things live because it's the rendering site that controls navigation, for example. So we also have a couple of features in the box to help keep you on the rails to make sure that when you use content deployment, you can use it confidently and deploying the parts that will succeed and will keep you on this sort of best practice architecture. So a quick illustration of how that would work. If you think about this topology here, where I've again got my multiple site collections, I've got my, let's call it primary content site collection, right? This is where I'd be authoring my non-sensitive content, so not my earnings reports, but my product information or whatever other things I think are safe enough, which is hopefully most of your content. There's another site collection here that's the target of content deployment. And again, that's your earnings report, other sensitive data. They're both being crawled. They're both seamlessly working through the rendering site. The rendering site doesn't even have to know which content comes from where. And over here, inside your corporate firewall, you'd make a content deployment source site collection. You turn on our marker feature. You'd set up a deployment path from the source site collection to your target. And you can deploy on whatever schedule you want. And again, the great thing about this, the rest of your site doesn't even have to be aware that content deployment is happening. Search is that aggregation point. It's crawling the content, whether it was authored there directly, whether it was imported from Dynamics or some other ERP system, whether it was content deployed, it all just works. Search abstracts that away and makes it a lot easier to manage. All right. So with that, I've tried my best to leave 15 minutes for questions. So if you do have questions, please come to the mic. I'd love to talk about them. I know I've thrown a lot of material at you. I'll also mention the recording's available or will be available, so please use it again. And one other note before everyone finishes walking out, I'm going to leave this slide up. You should think of it now as the set of other recordings you might want to watch. But I will say one last thing. A, thanks so much for attending the conference, and B, please do leave speaker feedback. For those of you who have any doubts about how important speaker feedback is at this conference, one of the biggest bits of feedback we got in the 2009 conference was, hey, we don't think you guys did enough in web content management in 2010. It was not that big of a change. We need more. And now there's a whole web track, and you've seen the product that we built. So that feedback goes, A, a long way to informing what we do in the future, and B, all of the speakers are competing. I really, really want a win top speaker. I have a side bet with a friend of mine. So if you liked the session, please leave feedback. If you did not like the session, please come up and get my business card, send me email, tell me what I could have improved in some other way. But thanks so much. Enjoy the last 2 hours of the conference, and I'll hang around for questions. Oh, and if you have questions, please walk up to the microphone so we can hear it on the recording. And we'll do that until we get kicked out of the room, I guess.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yes, the presentation will be online. Yes, I see you at the microphone asking your question. Of course. Yes. Oh, it's not. That's too bad. So sorry, you were saying you couldn't attend all the sessions, but... Oh, of course. Mm-hmm. So sorry, the question was how to leave feedback. If you go to the SharePoint Conference website or even the MySPC smartphone app, there's a tool to do session evaluation.